and roll. We got another Build Your Legacy webinar investment series with the co-host, the man, the myth, legend, Andy McMullen, and our guest of honor, Joseph Bramante. How the heck are you, dude?
Hey, man, I'm doing well. I'm doing well. You know, we'd be doing a little better if the Fed would back off the little bit with the rates. Wasn't a good day in the markets. Otherwise, doing okay.
Oh, I thought you were going to say because you're Houston, they really crashed.
You know, I'm just trying to pretend it didn't happen. You know, we're always setting records in Houston, and unfortunately, it wasn't a good record that we set last night.
There you go.
Hilarious. We got shut out by the Phillies in the World Series in Game 3. For those listening, who don't know the reference.
Hilarious. All right, cool. Okay. Matt, I've had you on the show before. We've talked about heavy repositioning, doing some work with family offices or institutional people that come in and invest with you. We'll go and dive down some of those rabbit holes later on. But for the audience that has not met you, or even the ones that are familiar with you but haven't caught up with you recently, tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into new development and heavy repositioning and capital raising and all that good stuff.
I'm an engineer by trade, worked for Exxon for first 5 years of my career, and then bought my first apartment complex in 2011. And that was a huge 30,000 per door renovation on a 25,000 per door acquisition. So kind of right out of the gate, we're doing big renovations. Spent first couple of years on that first deal, and then started buying about a deal per year thereafter. And this was in 2011. And in 2016, at that time, cap rates were coming down. We were already seeing a lot of compression. And when we were looking at development deals as compared to our existing acquisitions, we started realizing that, you know, in a not too distant future, it's going to make a lot more sense to build something than to buy something. So we had started working on that path in 2016, mostly just by ourselves, didn't do any partners, no co-GPs, no co-developers, no nothing. And that, and just to be clear, that is the absolute wrong way to do it. So first lesson, don't do that. And we spent a lot of time in development, learning the ropes. And here we are now today. Well, I mean, on the acquisition side, we've done about $375 million in transactions over that period, currently sitting at about 1,700 doors. We sold a couple properties last year. And we've got another $250 million in development deals that all break ground next year. So we've got the one deal that we started on in 2016 or 2017. And then we got two others that we were smarter and we partnered with a developer out of Dallas called Calterra. They're a great, great team, great group. And they're the lead developer on this deal. And because we had two amazing sites and we wanted them to be really amazing developments. And so we decided to kind of sit passenger on that one. So that was kind of the evolution of how we kind of transitioned into development, taking existing sites that we already owned and tearing them down to build new. The most recent one being a deal we bought a year ago. It was a 78 unit duplex on 5 acres that the broker contacted us because we're known for doing big value adds. And they said, hey, I think this is a value add. And I said, yeah, I think you're right. It's a very big one. I'm going to tear the whole thing down. We are doing the value add on that one, the development. And then in the meantime, I've gone back to school, getting my MBA. I graduate in May, so I'll have an MBA. Wow. Just today, actually, we announced that I'm writing my first book. So writing a book about passive investing, which will be, I think, really well received. Also hosted the Passive Investor Conference earlier this year, which was really well received. And then we launched Passive Investing Academy at the beginning of the year, which is, they're the same thing. You have an online program where you can kind of go through as a passive investor and learn the ropes, with, video guidance as well as Excel files there for you to learn the A to Z's of multifamily passive investing from the GPR down to net cash flow and all the other nuances to it.
So I got a ton of questions about that, but Andy, tell us about your development background. Where are you on the journey?
Yeah. So, I started a little before Joseph. I was probably a little bit more reluctant. So we were developing stuff in Venice Beach, California, probably 2006, 2004, really 2003 through 2006. And anybody in development understands that at some point the music stops and you're not really collecting on your development until all of your stuff is sold, right? And so with that kind of experience on the built to sell side, we started looking at opportunities in the multifamily. Over time, it became apparent that cap rates just kept compressing. You're starting to see the same cap rates on A, B, and C builds, right? And it just made so much more sense for us to start developing built to rent. We partnered up with a group that had been doing it for about 10, 15 years. And so we're really focused on projects in the Southeast where we can really easy topography, you know, not a whole lot of tree clearing. We try to be near good schools, obviously with amenities in secondary and tertiary markets with municipalities that are really favorable to us coming in their neighborhood and build them something beautiful. So that's kind of what we've been focusing on. I'm really excited to be here today because Joseph, I've heard him just crush some of the other operators. And so you guys are getting in for a treat here, hearing about all the things that you should not be doing. And if you guys text me a couple tough questions to maybe hit Joseph up with, that would be great as well. But I think I got plenty.
You feel free to put them in the chat too. And by the way, anybody that wants to network with developers, feel free to put your contact information in the chat. And then I forget, there's those little three buttons on the bottom of the chat that if you click them, you can save the chat. So keep that in mind. I'm Ruben. I'd never developed squat, not diddly anything until I met Mr. Andy McMullen. And then now we have a 98 unit built to rent and an 154 and then a 220 and then a 240. And now there's this new chat. That's not enough for Andy. So he's like, hey, let's take on this Chattanooga one too. So like we're going crazy and scaling incredibly quickly. And I'm just trying to like hold on for my dear life. So this has been a lot of fun, but I have a lot of questions for Joseph, and we're going to chat potentially. We're going to have a general conversation, run it much like a podcast, but some of the topics we might talk about: heavy repositioning, new development, working with family offices, raising capital, lending environment, passive investing academy, which I think Joseph alluded to a little bit, in-house construction, growing your development business. But before we go down any of those, I am curious about some of the stuff that you said in your opening statements. Joseph, you were talking about development was great. So I'm curious, what were the metrics that led you to believe that it was a smart move to get into development? I want to hear about that.
Yeah, so the metrics on a development side are really more about the multiple. It's a little unique now in today's market, but prior to recent times, you know, they were making 2.5 to 3 multiples pretty regularly on their deals. I had many investors and other, you know, deals with like Dienerstein, I forget exactly how you pronounce it, but I had one particular investor investing with that group and he was making 25 IRRs on a pretty regular basis. And he just kept going in and out over a 3-year period. But that has since kind of pulled back some, but that was the original, the metrics that we saw as far as why we liked it. But we also wanted to, you know, I remember studying the real estate cycle chart and you always had that nice little kind of sine wave there. And, but it doesn't end, right? It just continues going and going. It's a constant sine wave. And that was part of the reason why we went into development, is just knowing that, okay, well, this is cyclical. And that means there's going to be times to build and times to buy. And if I'm only able to buy, then that means that during other times of the cycle, I'm going to be doing nothing. So I wanted to be able to constantly stay busy, constantly stay in motion, constantly being able to work in all phases of the cycle. So that's why we transitioned into development when we did, because the best time to learn something is whenever, you know, you don't need it. So we didn't need to do development back then. There was plenty of opportunity on the acquisition side. And so we got to slowly build up our skills and learn about it. And so that now we're at the point where it's everybody's trying to transition to development, and we've been doing it for, I say doing it, right? But we've been working in it for the last several years, know what it takes to take a project all the way through zoning and permitting and approval and all that process. So the only thing that we haven't done yet is to break ground on our first deal, which that'll happen in February. Permits are approved and paid for. All we have left to do on that particular deal is just secure the financing and the equity. But that's where we're at on the development side. And that's why we made a transition. The other thing now I'll point out on that, on the metric side, and this is something that was explained to me recently because I was looking at the returns. And so I mentioned we're using our partner out of Calterra, out of Dallas, called Calterra. And they're doing all the underwriting for us. It's a different type of underwriting. It's very similar, but different. And one of the things I was not really critiquing, but I was just asking the question. I was like, hey, these returns look pretty similar to something that my acquisition investors would be used to getting. I mean, why would they go development versus acquisition if we're advertising almost identical returns? And he said, well, the difference is that the opportunity for outsized performance is much greater in development than it is in acquisition. So like an acquisition, I can underwrite a deal, I can buy it, and you know, I might advertise an 18% IRR, and if we knock it out of the park, we might get a 22. On development, you might advertise an 18 IRR, but if you knock it out of the park, you might get a 30. So, I mean, the ability to really outperform on development deals compared to acquisitions is the reason why a lot of investors go that development route, because they know that, you know, on a bad day, they might get an 18 or 19, but on a average or better than average day, they might get a mid 20s, and on a great day, they'll get a 30.
Cool. So we have some capital raisers in the room and some that are going to be listening in on the podcast that might be interested in working with you and partnering with you and or with Andy and myself. And they're very curious because value add, I think people are having a harder time finding deals, but they don't know development, but they see the value in it. And they're very curious. They're like, what do I need to tell my investors? How do I educate, nurture people on this particular path of build to rent and or vertical development? So do you have any words of advice for the person that's scaling or moving away from multifamily value add as a capital raiser or potential beginning capital raiser or experienced capital raiser? There's some experienced capital raisers in the room too that are also very interested in build to rent. What do they need to know about development in any kind of development, even self-storage development possibly? Like, what do they need to know in order to scale in this business?
Well, the first thing I would look at before making a potential investment in a development deal is you want to know that that project is shovel ready. You want to know that all the permits are in place, everything's ready to go, and that when you make that investment, the next move or very short period after is breaking ground. To get in on the early phase of a development deal is not recommended because you don't really have a good window of how long it's going to be until they break ground. Any number of things can come up that could completely derail the project. Maybe they don't get permitting, depending on where you're at, right? They don't get the permits, or they don't get the zoning, or during the design, they can't get the density, or the cost of materials go up. I mean, up until you break ground, everything is very much in flux. And thus, you want to make sure that, you know, to eliminate a lot of that risk and to know that you have a greater chance of achieving what's projected, you want to go in as a shovel-ready project. The other is experience. There is a lot of unknowns. This is not a linear development process. It's very much iterative. So you kind of go step one, step two, step three, four, back to step two, step three, skip to step seven and come back. So it's very much, you know, I like to think of it like kind of going around the toilet bowl. So you're in the beginning, you're just kind of going around and around and around. And eventually, as you get more and more detailed and your project gets more and more clear, and you refine the designs and everything, and you go through your budget cuts. Remind me to tell you the story about the budget cut we just went through on our podium deal. But as you go through that process and you finally get down to the ultimate project that you're going to build. So that's why you want to have an experienced operator who knows that process, because they can go through it faster and get you to the center faster than later. And then, you know, time is definitely of the essence on development, especially you've seen how things have been changing lately with material costs, with interest rate costs. I mean, granted, now we're in a bit of a unique period, but still, I mean, if you would have broke ground on a deal a year ago, you would be in a much better position than breaking ground on a deal now. Not to say that breaking ground on a deal now is bad, but I'm just saying it would have been better to do it a year ago because rates were lower and material costs were relatively the same. The other thing is to also always be looking for your exit and looking at when that exit is. So for us, the reason why a lot of people are doing development right now is because it takes 24 to 36 months to build and stabilize and exit a deal. So by the time you're exiting, what does the market look like when you're at that time? So we're, you know, if you're breaking ground next year, you're going to be exiting in 2026. there's a pretty good chance that the market will be past all this craziness that we're in now. We should be, you know, there'll be a new presidency we've gone through. So there's a lot of things you got to consider: the geopolitical world, the macro, the micro, all of that stuff, as well as what other developments are going on around you. So there's a lot of things that you consider that factor into that decision of, you know, this particular deal and the timing of it. The big one also is the debt. So the biggest difference is we're going non-recourse on acquisitions versus full recourse on development. That's a big pill to swallow for some people, which is why you want to have a very experienced team. So non-recourse, if that GP screws up, sorry, they give the keys back and the bank takes it over. I mean, people lose their equity, but the bank will handle it for the most part. On full recourse development deals, if you screw up, you can hand the keys back to the lender. They're going to give them right back to you. You own that. That's yours. You're responsible for that debt. And so you have to make sure that it will deliver the returns and deliver the value, more importantly, and that you're going to be able to exit and sell it for what you think you will. So that's a pretty big difference. Now, granted, you do on the lender side, they will step down. So it will start off as full recourse. And then usually around once you get your COs, and they do them buildings at a time. So as you start getting your certificates of occupancy, the recourse component will start ratcheting down. And then you end up with maybe a 25% recourse deal at the end of it, so that your risk exposure goes way, way down. But there is still in the very beginning where it is all on you.
So I'm going to pose a question to Andy. However, before I ask him, I'm curious, Joseph, what are you building? Is it like four-story garden style? What is it that you're developing?
So there's three types of developments that you can invest in generally. There's what's called garden style, which if you're doing acquisitions, older product, almost everything is garden style. That's where you have surface parking, and usually it's a two, three, or four-story building. And the parking is, you know, again, surface parking. You've got a wrap where it's a freestanding structured parking garage like you would see at a retail center. And the buildings are wrapped around it. So they are still freestanding stick build construction, and they're two separate buildings, the parking garage versus the residential buildings. And then you have the podium. The podium is where you have that same structured parking garage, but then you put the buildings on top of that parking garage. So that's going to be for your ultra high density type construction. In that same exact order, garden, wrap, and podium is the cost to build those. So your cheapest product and your lowest density will be garden. So if you have a lot of land and it's cheap, you want to do garden style. Your next most medium expensive will be the wrap component, the wrap development. So typically those are good for over 3 acres and, you know, under typically not more than 5 or 6 acres. Just because if you get to that big, you're going to have gigantic properties. So, and then the other component, the podium, that's your most expensive construction. And that one, you know, usually you see those on 3 acres and below. So we're doing, so those are three types. So we're doing all three right now. I've got a wrap that's on 5 acres. It's 375 units. That breaks ground in November. I've got a podium deal that sits on 1.6 acres. That's 245 units. That breaks ground in July. And then I've got a garden style deal that sits, well, that's total site's 26 acres, but it's two phases. So just phase one, I believe, is about 16 acres, and that one's 232 units. So very low density, stick build, very effective construction. We also have, in that particular development, we have some townhomes. So we've kind of incorporated the build to rent model into the garden style development to cater to both types of renters.
Very cool. Very cool. Andy, can you dissect some of the stuff that Joseph was talking about? How does it compare to, you know, the build to rent stuff that we're doing, the horizontal multifamily that we're doing? And then, you know, for some of the things that he said about the recourse versus non-recourse, does that apply? Is it the same? Talk to us a little bit about, you know, your advice for capital raisers getting into development too.
Yeah, so for many of the projects that we're doing, and then the other metric, you know, just kind of going back, that I think that most investors should consider when you're just kind of sizing up a deal is really that, just really simple, the yield on cost, which just basically means what is the total cost that you're putting in to build this project divided by what's the stabilized income, right? So if it's 2 years, it's 3 years, whatever that income that you're going to be getting at that particular time, what is that yield? And then you can kind of go from there. The yield spread would be the difference between that and the cap rates. So everything's kind of localized. So it's a lot harder to do some of these development deals, right? If you've got a high cap environment and you got a low yield, right? Because you're not going to be able to build like you used to be. And I think that's part of the reason that some of these heavy value add builders in the just apartment space got a little stuck, is because they started paying way more and they saw rents increasing, but they didn't foresee cap rates going up. But as far as lending, you know, so the deal that we've done in Lafayette, it's a 98 unit project, that's a non-recourse with a large lender. And so we're basically, we've already got the land, that we own the land already, right? So we're building the infrastructure and the vertical with them. So that's about, I think that's about a 12 acre site, pretty low density there on the built to rent stuff, right? We can build, you know, 98 units on small, you know, 12 acre site. In Alabama, you know, we've had to sign a recourse loan on, you know, just the land and the horizontal. We'll probably have to do a version of it. It's kind of a modified recourse, like what Joseph referenced, where, you know, they're not taking all of our assets, but we're going to have to designate a few that are collateralized. And I think in this market, what you're seeing now is a lot fewer specialty lenders that might let you kind of take some of that development lift, roll that some of that equity that you might have created in those phases. You're now really having to keep that skin in the game. So I think if you're going to be going into this development, which I think makes a lot of sense for the multifamily guys now, you're going to have to make sure that you're dealing with some operators that have the liquidity and net worth to kind of withstand, because any of the underwriting that we're doing, we're not even really accounting for refinances. We're just thinking, hey, if we've got to carry higher debt all the way through, does this project still make sense? If cap rates go from those fours up to six, does it still make sense? If prices go up on supplies or appliances or labor, do we still have a large enough contingency in place, right? So that's part of the reason that we really like the Southeast, because we know we can get land a lot less expensive. Materials have gone up a little bit, but I think you're starting to see values come down on the land side. So I think there'll be some more opportunities for people that are really kind of smart about the projects that they're working on. But I think what the most important thing that people want to see at this point in time, especially coming from the multifamily space, is what are those risk mitigants in place? Like if Joseph's seeing, you know, 17%, you know, IRR, which I would argue is, you know, less important than the yield on cost, but let's just say that multifamily in comparison to a development project is 17% IRR. Don't stop there, right? Like, what would have to happen for you not to execute the plan? As Joseph was mentioning, there's such a huge delta of things that can go wrong in a development project, right? From the prices, from the speed, which is the most important thing on how quickly you can get actually something done, which is why you could stabilize a project sooner and get that 30% IRR, you know, as opposed to a multifamily project where it's pretty a steady kind of renovation schedule. So those would be the things is really, if you're marketing a project, lead first with a lower IRR with a lot of risk mitigants rather than trying to go after that higher IRR, you know, so it looks good on all of your materials, because ultimately it's going to get picked apart. I think most people want to see a little bit safer deal, even on the development side today.
Very cool. So we got about 10 to 15 minutes before we open it up for questions. So start prepping those. But Joseph, I want to hear about the raising capital, you know, potentially working with family offices. How does that apply to, you know, your development business? And then we'll give you a little bit of time to talk about Passive Investing Academy. And then I'll let Andy direct some questions at you, and then we'll open it up to the audience.
Great. Yeah. So, and all great points that Andy brought up, the yield on cost. I don't know how I missed that one, but yeah, that one's definitely one of the top metrics that you're looking at. And he described it perfectly. The family offices that we're talking to, I'll tell you, I was actually at the game one with one of them for the first game of the World Series and with one of them. And so we had a lot to talk about. They're not doing acquisitions.
Was there a bunch of banging on?
Stop it. Stop it.
This guy. I'll tell you, they're not doing acquisitions right now. Nobody, none of the family offices I know are looking at any acquisitions. Everybody is transitioned to the development space for the time being, because it's just nothing's making sense for them on the acquisition side. But I mean, granted, I'm not saying that acquisitions are completely dead, although we also are not doing acquisitions because we just feel like there's gonna be better deals to be had if we just wait it out. You know, I don't really want to try and catch a falling knife. I'd rather it hit the floor and then pick it up and then go from there. So we feel like there's just too much influx on the acquisition side to and family offices are the same. As far as working with them, it's really a relationship business. It's, you know, staying in front of them. I've got a trip to Dallas next week to, you know, meet with several of them in person. And it's just constantly maintaining and building the relationship over a period of time. That's how you do it. It's not rocket science. There's nothing really special about it. It's just staying in front of them, building relationship, letting them know what you're up to. And that's really it. And get used to hearing no a lot, because they're going to tell you no for 9.9% of your deals. 99.9% of your deals is going to be a no, but all you need to hear is yes one time and you're golden. You're going to want to have a stable of family offices, so you don't just bank on one. You're going to have, you know, my mentor has got five. He's got five really good offices that he works with. And all he needs is one of those five to say yes on any particular deal. He doesn't do any syndication. He does strictly family office. And that's kind of, that was the advice he gave to me. It was just get you a stable five or so offices that you've got a relationship with, and just continue to keep that relationship strong and keep showing them deals and keep them informed of what you're doing, and just don't get discouraged.
So tell us about the Passive Investing Academy. What is that all about? Is that a new thing? Is that something you've been working on for a while?
That is a COVID baby. So that was something, I was locked in my apartment as everybody else was. And I said, you know what, I'm going to make this course because I had nothing else to do. So we created this course, and the outline is very simple. Pull out a trailing 12, look at all the cost line items. And that is the basically the first section of the course, is that we walk line by line on the profit and loss statement from the GPR down the net cash flow. And it's about 8 hours of content, just edited content, just on that. So imagine spending 8 hours on a P&L. I don't think many people realize you could actually do that, but there is plenty to talk about on each particular line item. And we kind of get into the nitty gritty. There's also, you know, so I was on Shark Pool, which is a multifamily version of Shark Tank. So I was one of the sharks there, and all of my recorded episodes are also there for free for people to see. And I'm using the same tools and techniques that I teach in the course, but on Shark Pool. But the interesting thing about that is that you see, which is kind of hard to teach and to illustrate, is the natural response from sponsors on deals. So I think, you know, passive investors need to realize that by the time that they're seeing a deal, it's already under contract, there's hard money down, they're, you know, probably over halfway through the closing process. If anything's discovered or pointed out in the underwriting, the chances of, you know, I just feel like some passives think that they're going to correct the sponsor, and the sponsor is going to be like, you know what, you're right. I was totally wrong on this. I'm going to change the entire pro forma and projections and update all the passive investors and let them know, hey, we made a mistake here, and their actual return is maybe 12% IRR and not 20. That's never going to happen. The reality is that you're just going to get ghosted, and you're going to go off to the side. They might stop responding to you, and they're going to keep marketing the same exact material, because that's just the name of the game. That's how it is. It's not in their best interest to, you know, turn this thing around. So I think it's interesting, because when I ask those same questions and we poke these same holes into people's deals and you see them try to give the same response, I think a lot of passive investors, when they hear the response, they kind of back down, and they don't know, they need to kind of stand their ground. They know that, oh no, this, it's correct. So anyway, that was the Shark Pool. The whole course was, there's like the high level version where it's like, hey, we're just going to teach you the theory. And then there's a more detailed version where it's like, hey, if you really want to, like if you have nothing better to do at your time, here's some Excel and here's how you can completely reverse engineer their entire pro forma. But you shouldn't do this on every deal, only on deals that maybe are looking at investing a large amount of money into.
Fascinating.
Yeah, Andy. Ruben, I got a comment on this because I've, you know, I've been both a shark on Shark Pool. I actually think I was on one time with Joseph. But you know what I think is so interesting about what you do, Joseph, is you are not accepting that simple kind of, you as you just hit on, that simple kind of, oh yeah, here's the answer and then let's move on to the next thing. You're really digging in. And I'm wondering if there's something, because it does seem to me that, and I invest as a passive on deals as well, it does seem to me that there are a lot of sponsors out there that maybe it's kind of a benefit of this last wave that we've hit where it's just everything is going up. But it does seem to me that there's very kind of few operators that are really crisp with their numbers and their knowledge. So I'm just curious, like, where did this contempt come from? Like, because I noticed there's like this, I mean it respectfully, but there's like a real kind of ire at some of these deals that are getting presented to passive investors. And I think that was part of the impetus for the program. Give me some trends. Are you seeing a lot better conservatively underwritten deals? Or are you seeing a lot worse over the last couple of years?
Well,
and you don't have to name names.
Yeah, no, I would never name names. Good, but we're not going to name names. There's definitely, so here was a big warning sign for me. Like, I went to the best ever conference this year, and it's a great conference. I think it's a fantastic conference. It does a lot of really good for people. But the thing that was concerning for me was when we went there, the question was asked, how many people are here are first time syndicators and sponsors? There were over 1,000 people that attended, and at least 30% raised their hand. And so the concern for me was like, man, you've got 300, 500, 1,000 people joining the industry every single year, and we're not even building that many units. I mean, we're not building that many properties to be buying and buying over. And so there's a natural, there's no way that we can maintain the same volume of deals and have this many new buyers and keep the quality up that high. I mean, it's just not possible to keep high quality and have a high number of buyers, brand new buyers, not making any mistakes. You know, I was a new investor at one time. We all were new. We all made the same exact mistakes. I taught myself multifamily. I was overseas, Papua New Guinea, and read books and learned the hard way. I didn't really have any mentors at that time to kind of take me by the hand. So I just learned trial by fire. And I've been on the other side of that where I had to, you know, investor only made, you know, he made a 2.5 multiple, but I told him a 4. You know, because my underwriting was messed up. And so I'm having to explain to this guy why he only made a 2.5, not a 4. And I realized that, you know, these guys really believed the underwriting. It doesn't matter how many times you say, hey, this is, it's just a pro forma, it's an estimate. They're going to write that down and put it in stone as fact. And you better hit that number. And it doesn't matter how many times you say it's just an estimate. And they're not going to really question things. And that was the other, what triggered this whole thing. There were two things that triggered the entire course and all of this. The first was I actually took the other approach initially, and I happened to see somebody's deal, like we all do. We all see each other's deals on LinkedIn. And this one deal in particular, I remember thinking, it's like, wow, this one's pretty aggressive. It's like a 50% occupied building. It was 800 units. And I was just like curious about it. So I attended the guy's webinar and start breaking down some of the numbers, and I was like, wow, this is way, way, way off. Like, not even a little bit. Like, this is like a crash and burn type deal. And I approached the sponsor, and he basically told me to screw off. And that's when I realized, and I tried doing it politely with a few others, and I realized that these guys really don't want my opinion. They don't really care, and it's not in their best interest to change anything. And that's when I realized, you know, at that point, it's like, yeah, because they're pot committed. For those who play poker, you know, once you're all in on a hand, you're not just going to back out. At some point, you just got to, when the river comes, you're just going to keep going. You just got to play it. It doesn't matter if you know the other guy's got, you know, 4 of a kind or something. So anyway, that was my first revelation, was like, you're not going to change the sponsors. It's not in their best interest to do the deals correctly. And I'm sorry, I'm not saying that they're intentionally doing them wrong. I'm just saying that they're incentivized to close deals, make acquisition fees, and keep on going about their business. So for them to do to underwrite deals perfectly means they're going to close on less deals. So that was the first like realization, was like, you know, that's kind of going against each other. And the second was I had investors sending me deals, because you know, we only were doing at that time about a deal per year. And so they would send me deals and I would, you know, just freely say, hey, sure, I'll look at it and yeah, good deal, you should invest in that one. But I would get sent these deals and I would send it back in, you know, a few minutes and point stuff out, and my investors were completely clueless. And these are guys that are investing with me. And I'm like, how do you not see this stuff? And I'm like, what do you think about my deals? Like, I send you these things and like they don't ask me any questions. And so they just go with it. And that was,
can I ask you, like, what would be some of the, like, just for that, because I know there's probably a lot of questions, but like, what are some of the things that you're seeing? Is it like exit caps aggressive? Is it like, you know, maybe the budgets? Is it rents? I know you kind of look at it holistically first and then you probably dig into the deep, but is there any like common themes that you're seeing, or is it really just people aren't taking the time?
Yeah, I always, as you kind of allude to, I take a wide view and go in. So my first thing is the market. Right. And like the common thing we saw on Shark Pool a lot was they would cherry pick deals to be their comps, and they would be multiple miles away, like not even a 1 mile radius, but like 3 and 4 miles away. And that was their comp. And I'm like, that's not right. And so anyway, that's the first thing. And it stops there. Like if that's wrong, then I'm off to the next deal. I don't even need to look any further. But then the next thing is then you go into the numbers. Well, actually, then I go into the sponsor themselves and I see, hey, what's your experience? You know, don't tell me you've been doing this. You've been in real estate for 14 years. If only 2 of those years is in multifamily, seen that before. So really just kind of dig into what their experience is and their track record. You should ask them and they should be able to answer it almost immediately what their track record is. And if they start hemming and hawing and making excuses right out of the gate, then, you know, not a good sign. And then I get into the numbers, and some of the common things I see on the numbers, my pet peeve is I always go straight to the loss to lease. I mean, granted, that is more of a interim cash on cash impactor, but it can, depending on when the exit is, impact the returns, because maybe if they're showing very low loss to lease, it might require more cash up front or a cash call. It can really impact things depending on the size of the deal. So that's my first thing that I go to. And then the vacancy, you know, I see this a lot where they're doing big value adds and the vacancy stays 95% or 5% vacant, 95% occupied. Like mathematically, that's not possible. So, and then, you know, taxes are a big one. You kind of look at taxes I really hate this term of economic vacancy. A lot of people are using it. It's like a real lazy way to underwrite, and it can really shadow and hide a lot of the assumptions that are really important as a passive. So, you know, if I see stuff like economic vacancy, I get very concerned. If I do not see a trailing 12, that's probably my first red flag, is if I don't see a trailing 12 next to that year one pro forma, then everything from year one on is just a bunch of made up numbers. I have no reference to anything. And if you're a passive and if you don't see a trailing 12 column that's right next to that year one column, you should be very concerned. So those are the kind of things that I look at when I'm looking at deals.
Great stuff. Ruben, I didn't know if you want to hit questions or not. So
yeah, I definitely want to hit questions. I have more of my own. Joseph's given some crazy fire answers. They're so good. So didn't want to interrupt him. But Aaron Bress has a question. When you guys look at yield cost and spread, what are favorable numbers we should be looking for? And then after you answer this, hopefully we can keep this short so we can get a few other questions in there. Then we'll open it up to the audience.
Well, I think just in general, like the projects that we're going, we'd like to see a 7 and above. I know some people like a 6 and above. And the reason why I use that number, Aaron, is because really you're comparing that yield on cost to what the cap rate in that area. So in built to rent, for example, you might see cap rates that are in the 4s or 3s or if they're 5s, whatever that is. You got to basically consider what that delta is from that yield on cost to that cap rate, because that's ultimately going to be telling you how much value you've created. So let's say, you know, you've got a 7% yield on cost and you got a 5% cap rate, you got that those 2-point spread, right? And you're dividing that by what that cap rate is. So you got, you know, 40% value you've created, something in that range. So that's a pretty good spread. I mean, that's a pretty good margin. If you're, you know, if you're down in that 20s for the margin, there's, as Joseph said, there's just so many things that can go wrong. So I think that you got to make sure that there's enough of that kind of value creation opportunity once you get it stabilized at those rents. And how quickly can you get to that point where it's stabilized?
Joseph, do you want to comment on that, or do you want
to? I mean, the great explanation again, but the I'll just add on to that a little bit is, you know, so we're in the kind of 6% range, and the low 6% of year 7, but also, again, like you said, it depends on the market you're in. So if the market has a lower cap rate going in and your spread is really what you're targeting, you really want that nice, you know, we are looking at like a 1.5% spread to 2 is great, but that really is your margin. And another thing just to keep in mind is that the bigger the deal, the less wiggle you're going to have on your yield on cost. So if it's a smaller deal, it's more susceptible, but think of it like a, you know, like a big ship. You know, it's hard to move the ship so much. It would take a really big impact. So these deals are a bit resilient when it comes to the bigger deals are more resilient when underwritten well and to that certain point versus the smaller deals, it, you know, less can knock it off course than a bigger deal, if that makes sense.
Mm. Who's got a question? We want to open it up. What do you guys want to know about development?
The other cool thing about development, though, is you've got multiple exit options. So, you know, we talked about refinancing as one and exiting as the other, but there's also the, you know, you can roll to perm, which is similar to refinancing, but sometimes you can build it with a loan that just rolls straight to permanent, basically a refinance. But the beautiful thing about that is, I mean, what we're really after in all of us, acquisition or development, what this is really about, it's cash flow and buying revenue streams. Anytime you make an investment, you're purchasing a revenue stream. And with new development, you're able to purchase a revenue stream at a discount because your basis or your purchase price was just the cost to construct it versus the actual value and the return you're going to get would be that of a, you know, market rate newer deal. So your basis might be $180,000 per door, but it's worth $250,000 per door. So if you were to try and buy it on the market, you would pay $250,000 to get the cash flow of that property. Instead, you built it at for $180,000 a door, and you get the revenue and cash flow of a $250,000 per door property. So you get much higher revenues and cash flows on new development if you're of that mindset. You know, a lot of people still prefer just to flip out of them and exit and double, but personally, I like the build and hold model the best.
Haley wants to know, do you charge your investors a development fee? If so, how much?
Yeah, so the development fee will range between 3-4%. And there's also a construction management fee of about 1%. So it all depends on the project, the sizing, and everything like that.
What do you typically charge, Joseph, for an asset management or exit? Do you guys do also do a disposition fee usually on your deals?
No, we keep it simple. We do IRR hurdles on the exit. And so once we get over a 16 or 18, depending on the deal, so it's 80-20 over a 12. And then once you get over, I believe, an 18, then it goes 60-40. So that's from a GP perspective, it's nice because you get, you know, there's typically a larger promote that you'll get on the back end, but you have to work for that promote. It's a lot harder. It's a lot more moving parts.
And what are you telling investors as far as cash flow? You get that question a lot. You say,
hey, yeah, that's another one. People love this cash flow thing. And it's like, yeah, there's no cash flow. Just forget about cash flow. This is an exit play. You're playing on exit. There will be some, but do not invest in this deal and think anything about cash flow because there's no property for at least 18 months. It's just brownfield. And so I think that's a great comment. I forgot to bring that one up, but yeah, that's probably one of the harder pills to swallow for people switching from acquisitions to development is this whole idea of cash flow. And you're used to having it on one hand, and on the other, on development, there is none. But you do get a really nice multiple.
So Kaylee was asking about ideal hold period. I think that is a pretty loaded question because that changes depending on your investor. Rick Benson wants to know, do you accrue the preferred?
Yes, we accrue the preferred. It's you know, preferred acts the same on acquisitions as does development. I think most people accrue their preferred returns, or I hope they do. So if they're not getting paid, then at the end when we sell, the first payment goes to pay off all those preferred returns that are owed and accrued.
I'd be curious on Rick's, because Rick has some projects too. Go ahead, Ruben. Maybe we'll interview Rick another time, but I know he's got some product. I'm curious if you're doing that.
So
what else?
I was curious, you know, one of the topics that we had at the very beginning was growing your development business. Any thoughts or comments on that, Joseph?
Yeah. If you are somebody in acquisitions and you're trying to grow out of into development, you know, the challenges with development is first finding a site. You know, they're not just everywhere. You can't just go out and, you know, and we kind of cheated the system a little bit in that we were buying older existing properties that we knew one day we were going to tear down. And so we were, you know, we were planning on going into development from a very long time ago. So that's the lowest, least risk way to do it. Now you still have opportunities like that, because oftentimes if you're in the acquisition space, your brokers are acquisition brokers or, you know, buy sell brokers. So they may not recognize a development site when they have one, and they typically are old properties, low density, and they can be anything from multifamily to trailer parks to car washes, you know, anything. So the first thing is, you know, having a site. The second is finding somebody to partner with, which can be a little bit tricky, you know, because a lot of times they, you know, we talked to several developers, and there is no kind of general understood terms. They will vary widely as we experienced. And so ultimately you're just going to meet with a bunch of developers who have really good experience, preferably that are in your locale, they're in your area, because you're going to want to be involved, because ultimately you want to be doing the development yourself. And it'll probably take you 5 years. This is not a quick thing, because development in general is slow. And to go through the entire development process, just to get from closing on a site to getting all the way a fully permitted set of drawings is about 9 months. So that doesn't include the equity raise, the debt, all that, and then the breaking ground. Then you got to actually build it. That's a whole another phase. So it's complex, and you're going to want to partner until you feel very comfortable doing it yourself.
This will be the last question of the day. Andrew Stimson wants to know, what are the different exit options? What could a typical equity gain look like at each exit stage?
Yeah, sure. So from an IRR perspective, your best option is to exit fast, because you basically have no cash flow for 2 years. So you make a big investment and you get nothing for 2 years. And then for you to just turn around and resume cash flow on a deal, it would take quite a lot. And you would have to have either an exit or a really big refinance. So depending on the deal, right? If it was a really juicy deal, then you could maybe do a refinance and it'd be worthwhile. But typically your exit timeframe is going to look at 3 years, and those returns in today's market would be, you know, low twos on the equity multiple, and then the IRRs could be in the high teens. You start getting out further than that, your equity multiple will go up to, you know, threes, but your IRR will start taking a hit because you've extended it out, and you might be in the mid to low teens on your IRR, but you got a better multiple and you cash flowed. The thing is, you will most likely have cash flowed very well after it's built. So that's the other trade-off. It's like, yeah, my IRR took a hit, but I was getting, you know, high single digit, very dependable, very healthy cash flow out of the deal. So, you know, do I really care about the IRR? You know, some would say no.
Damn, we could write a book just based off of the stuff that we talked about.
Yeah, great stuff.
Show. That was excellent. Incredible. Wow. All right. Cool, man. That was amazing, Joseph. Thank you so much for coming on. And thanks for all the audience members. I know this was a quick one. We didn't really have time to promote it too much, but thank you for everybody that came on here. We're going to also release this as a podcast, so we'll get probably another 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 listens over the next year or so. So this has been amazing. Thank you so much, Andy. Thanks for hosting and that some great questions that you asked. And with that, we're going to let you guys go. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks, Joseph, guys.
I'll be in touch, brother. Thank
you. Appreciate you guys.
Legacy Acquisitions